Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by Elec K25. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM and 97.5 HD2, a part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend talking about all the news in the world of sports. Could you have imagined that at Memorial Weekend, the Phillies would be 23 games up in right now?
It would be exactly what I predicted on some other planet in some other universe. But on this one, I think we should at least just acknowledge to ourselves, even if nobody else would care. This, I believe, was the Friday, Memorial Day weekend when we were moved to drive time.
I've lost count of how many years now we've been doing it together in drive time. Then again, I've lost count of how many years we've been doing the show. I always joke you're one of my longest relationships outside of my wife.
Are you counting in dog years or are we counting
it
in
only it only feels like dog years.
Yeah, there you go.
We started, for our listeners who don't go all the way back, we started as a Sunday morning show at 10 a.m. We moved to Saturday at 1 p.m. and I guess somebody liked what we were doing a little bit to say, hey, go on the radio on Fridays. Either that or they just had an empty slot and said, hey, can you fill it for us? One or the other, but we stuck.
And here we are.
Yeah, we're still here. We're still talking. And I believe
when we started on Fridays, the Phillies kind of sucked.
They did.
And that is not the case right now because they have the best record now it's more than 50 games, but after 50 games since 2001 Mariners, which, by the way, that didn't end up too well. So let's not focus on that. But it is amazing.
We'll get to the Mariners in a second because Rob Thompson was asked about that this week and he had a really good response. But you know, I like to kind of have stats for you and kind of make your mind go numb with it. Mm-hmm. The Phillies finished their homestand at 7-1, including back-to-back sweeps. They've swept 7 series this year. They swept 8 all of last year. They're 17-3 in May. This year they lost their 10th game on April 24th. In the last 4 weeks, they're 21-4, and they are now 6 games up on the Braves.
And for those people, which there are a lot of them that go, well, it's because of the schedule. Lots of teams play lots of crappy other teams and don't do this well. And when people say, well, teams aren't over 500, as Rob Thompson pointed out, everyone they're playing is around 500. There aren't that many teams that are over 500. There's a lot of parity. And by the way, the team they just swept, what did they do last year?
They won the World Series, and they were over 500 before they came in here, but they lost 3 games in a row, so now they're under 500. And
they're not just beating other teams. They're annihilating other teams.
They are.
I mean, their run differential during this particular stretch is insane.
It's huge. They've scored 4 or more runs in 13 straight games. In the 4 games they've lost in the last 4 weeks, it's been by a total of 5 runs. They're plus 90 in the games that they've won. And for that, they've played weak opponents. They've played 6 of the top 25 pitchers this year in terms of ERA. Those 6 pitchers against the Phillies have a nearly 7 ERA against them. So it's not just the record of the team or not. It's that this team is playing really, really good, solid baseball. And that's fun for, like I said, when you say we were doing this show, the Phillies weren't that good. My God, those lineups. And we were doing the minor league show, too, around that time. So, like, we're going to see the guys coming up going, all right, these lineups at the majors are bad. Here's the guy in the minors that are coming up. And it's like, not quite as much there either. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, look, your guy, Alec Bohm, who that first masterful interview you both had together after he was drafted. I mean, he's hitting .343 and is second in majors in RBIs behind Marcelo Ozuna with 46. JT Realmuto, who I have longed over on this show to the point that you've wanted me to, like, get him flowers and stuff like that for as much as I've talked about loving JT Realmuto, through his downtimes, has a 13-game hit streak, and since moving to the two-hole in 12 games, hitting .377 with 20 hits, 3 doubles, and a home run.
Right.
So, I mean, the bats are doing it right now. Even
Harper's heating up. It's not like Harper's, like, quietly great this season. His batting average is not super. It's not bad, but he's hitting home runs. He's hitting clutch home runs. He's playing really good first base. And he's stretching the counts. Him and Bryson Stott, the whole team in general, But him and Bryson Stott are so selective in pitches, but not over-selective, which there is a way to do that. You can be over-selective and just miss good pitches. They're not missing good pitches. They're making pitchers make the pitch that they want to hit where they want to hit it.
And you talk about the Seattle team. Rob Thompson was asked about that this week, and he said, well, what did they win? And the reporter said 116 games. And ultimately his question was, but what did they win? Like, they didn't win the World Series, and that seems to be...
They didn't make the World Series, did they?
No, and that seems to be what the kind of the motto of this team is. He was asked yesterday after the win, and he said that they want to finish business from last year, and even the new guys that come in have that attitude. And I told you the other day, I want this team to win, not just because I want to see a team win, but these guys are fun, and I want... This team and these personalities be remembered in this town as winners, like that 08 team was, where, I mean, you remember Pat Burrell wasn't the warmest personality going into those years. Nope. He's beloved after the parade and his dog on the float and what he did, and just these personalities and these guys, I would like to see them continue this to get that recognition in this city.
Well, stay hungry and stay healthy.
So I got a question for you. What do you think they do? We'll get to the pitching in a little bit, which has really carried them. You know, the hitting has been really good. The pitching has just been like spectacular, record setting in places. But what do you do with the roster when Trey Turner comes back? Sosa's three hit game yesterday is the Phillies' 29th individual three hit game. Cody Clemens has played very well. He's really the only one with any options of position players, because Pache you'd have to release, Sosa or Merrifield you'd have to release. Do you take an arm out of the bullpen and send it down to keep Cody Clemens up here? Do you send Clemens down?
No. If you do that, then you're asking to tax your pitchers more.
Okay.
The pitching is why they will win a World Series. The hitting is why they will score runs, but the pitching is what will win them. And you cannot risk, by having too few pitchers, having to put tax on the bullpen and also risk, look, these pitchers at some point, I know that it's horrible to say this, are going to have bad games.
Yes.
Ranger will lose a game this year at some point.
Of course.
Wheeler will have a game where he only pitches four innings. Nola will have a game where he gives up two home runs. Those things are going to happen. When those things happen, you have to have the bullpen there that can do multi-innings. You cannot take somebody off because you want to save Cody Clemens. The answer to me is, if you close your eyes, who's the guy that you would forget about if I asked you to do the entire Phillies roster? The answer is Pache.
But he's the young guy, and I don't think they want to give up on him yet. They also got him in the trade that gave Ohapi there, and so I don't think they want to give up on that. So I don't think Pache is the guy that goes. So I understand that in general manager Jeff Cohen's perfect world, that's what you do, but I don't think that's what this team... I think ultimately it's Cody Clemens that gets sent down, even though he's hot. I don't know that that's necessarily the right decision. I mean, Whit Merrifield has struggled at the plate. He was like 1-for-23.
Well, that him they're not giving up on.
No, because
That was their big offseason signing.
Well, and he gives them flexibility if there are injuries to kind of move guys around. Now, stop being able to move around to play shortstop definitely helps them too in terms of that optionality. Your thoughts on...
You realize how, when you have that discussion, how good the team has played.
Absolutely.
Forget records. If we're worried about literally the last guy on the bench, that's what we're worried about right now. Your $300 million shortstop is going to come back, who was having a great beginning of the season. And now we're worried. I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm just saying that that's how good this team has played, is that we're worried about Pache. Although I'll tell you, if you ask me who I would get rid of,
Pache is who you...
No, who? No. I would take his salary and I would say
Castellanos. I know.
Yes.
Even though he's been a little more disciplined at the plate this week.
Again, there's discipline, lack of discipline, and Castellanos' lack of discipline. And if you believe, I wish He seems like a nice guy. You want him to succeed, but let's face it. We have enough of a sample now to know that he may be disciplined for a tiny short period of time. There's going to be a game sometime in the next week or two where he swings at pitches that you are going to look at and go, which field is he on?
He does that even when he's hitting well.
Right.
There are pitches in the at-bat where you're like, why did he swing at that?
I understand his salary component. You can't give up on us. You cannot risk this season not ending up with a World Series because of that.
I also
that
can't
be the reason.
I also can't now let my 7-year-old listen to this show this week because he's next time he does something wrong, he's just going to be like, I'm undisciplined like Castellanos, Dad. Like, that's not going to fly in this house, Jeff.
You're going to cut him?
I'm going to cut my kid. That's exactly right. What's going to happen. I mean, you talk about how good the offense is. They're first in runs. This is in all of baseball, not the National League. First in runs, first in RBIs, first in on-base percentage, second in average, third in walks, sixth in home runs, tied for fourth in triples, fourth in hits, fourth in stolen bases. I mean, it's just...
Can I just ask you a question? Isn't it redundant to say that you're first in runs and first in RBIs? Wouldn't one go with the other?
Well, you are the guy who is the baseball traditionalist, and the baseball gods decided that we would keep separate stats for runs and RBIs.
No, so I understand
that.
But when you're saying a team leads the league in runs, unless they're scoring a whole lot of them on errors, likelihood is they lead the league in RBIs.
Not necessarily. They could have solo home runs. They could have ways to score runs without getting RBIs.
No, if you score a solo home run, you get an RBI and a run.
Yeah, but not like three or four like they're getting at a time. So they don't have to lead the league RBIs.
You listen back to this conversation at some later date, and you'll see what I'm asking you.
I don't like it when I listen back. I always feel like I say stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to the pitchers. And, you know, we talked to Jamie Moyer a few weeks ago about how pitchers are changing and all effort, and they go shorter. And here you got Wheeler, Suarez, and Nola, who have combined for 15 starts of 7-plus innings. That's three more than any other entire team's total. They have 18 starts of 7-plus innings in 2024. That's more than 11 teams had all of last season. Let's talk about not just how well they're pitching, which we'll get to their ERAs, but how long in games they're pitching and how that's helped the bullpen.
I can't imagine what it's like to be in the bullpen right now.
You're sitting there twiddling your thumbs, waiting to go, do I pitch tonight?
Yeah, you literally get to say, okay, I'm ready. But the first 7 innings, I get to just sit back and chill. And I likely know that I'm going in there with a lead. Like, it's very demoralizing as a relief pitcher to know that you have to come into a game where you're losing. That doesn't happen right now.
That's not with this team. They jump out early in the first 2 innings. The starters have the third best ERA in the league behind just the Red Sox and the Yankees at 3.14. I'm going to read these numbers to you. They're crazy. Ranger Suarez, 1.36 ERA. Zach Wheeler, 2.53 ERA. He's second in the league in strikeouts with 76. Aaron Nola, 3.05. Chris Sanchez, 3.31. And then your boy Taijuan Walker bringing up the rear at 5.06. But that's the...
And remember, we still have Spencer Turnbull,
who has been better than Taijuan Walker and is now in the bullpen doing things. So... I mean, the way that this team has been able to have their starters go deep into games, and, you know, you talk about stress on the arms. They're not stressful innings most times. They're quick innings. They're pitching with a lead. They're not...
Nola started a game last week with the six-pitch inning.
You just can't... You can't do better than what they've had. And like you said, they're going to struggle. But you look at Ranger, he's the only major league pitcher ever to go undefeated with a sub 1.5 ERA and 65 plus strikeouts in his first 10 starts. That's since they've been tracking in 1913.
You know, the only thing more fun if you love watching pitching than watching Ranger is watching Wheeler and Nola in the dugout be
watching
amazed
him.
At what Ranger's doing.
I love how he gives the player hope when he's like slow in fielding it. He like lets them kind of run as hard as they can and then he just fires it over at the last second.
Ever since we saw Ranger in in the minor leagues.
Where do we first see him? At Double A? Is that, or do we see him at Single A?
I think we saw him at Lakewood. I saw him do his first game, pitch his first game in Double A, sat behind home plate. And he was one of those guys that you literally would watch him. And I think I've said this on the air before, but he's like the guy in like all those baseball movies who the pitcher winks at the batter as if he knows something more than him. And the batter just sits there and goes, that's the, I've never seen a guy that walked onto a man with like this smug confidence, not like the Roy Halladay intensity or the Zach Wheeler intensity. There's like a smirk when he walks on the mound. There's a smirk when he gets his ball. And just like when you say a ground ball comes to him, there's a smirk and like, go ahead, keep running. Yeah,
he's like, try me. Go for right. it. Try me. We got to give a shout out to our guy who we talked to a couple times, Sal Agostinelli, the scout that found him. $25,000, Jeff. Got you Ranger Suarez.
Yeah, well, I don't know what he's getting after this year, but it's going to be something.
Oh, it's definitely going to be a lot more. Let's go to the bullpen real fast. Again, look at these.
Bye-bye, Soto. I'll short-circuit this for you, and then we can discuss it if you still want to discuss it. My wish list is Soto, go.
They won't do that until they bring in another arm, but I do think that as they go into the trade deadline, they're going to look for a right fielder for Castellanos and another arm for the bullpen. But the arms that they have, I mean, Jeff Hoffman, 1.25 ERA. Matt Strom, 0.87 ERA for Matt Strom. Keckering.
Strom, I saw it. I did not see this coming with Hoffman.
I told you
last year, I just didn't have confidence when he came into a game. Now, it's just impressive watching the way he pitches.
Orion Kerkering, 1.84 ERA. And I mean, you laughed at me last year when I was like, oh, maybe he'll come up and be on the postseason roster. And of course, he struggled in the postseason. But lightly. That experience seems to have helped him a lot in terms of where he is coming into this season, his confidence level. And then you've got the man with the highest ERA is your general closer, Jose Alvarado. That's 3.38. So, I mean, these guys are coming in, and it's not just the start of the game, the first six or seven innings with the starters. It's the bullpen that comes in, and they don't give any life or any hope to the other team.
When you talk about football, you want a team that plays great on offense, defense, special teams. You got that in baseball right now.
When did they get a good defense? Because for years, we would complain about their defense. The errors, Reese at first base, you know, we knew what he was, but he wasn't. Bryce at first base is very good.
He is very good. Impressively, I did not think, look, people think first base is where you go if you can't play any other position. As somebody who coached a little baseball, I can tell you, at first base is a very difficult position to play. You go over there and try to catch balls when people are throwing them as hard as they are all over the place and try to keep your foot on the base. And how to communicate when you need to know when a ball is to your right. There's all sorts of things. And for a guy who never played it to have picked this up under a difficult situation because of his injury, and excel the way that he has tells you what kind of great athlete he is, but what kind of great competitor he is as well.
And the fans aren't, well, and he's also really good at promposals too. I never would have been able to do that. I'm so glad that we didn't.
I still don't understand the promposal.
I'm so glad we didn't have to do that in high school.
Like, is it not?
I could barely ask somebody out anyway. You have to get creative and do stuff around it and be like, oh my God.
Yeah. How much pressure do you need to put on yourself? And by the way, are we all that insecure at this point that we need if somebody asks us to do something that we now need to make an issue out of like a whole spectacle out of being asked?
Yes.
Why?
Apparently I'm going to get to it with my kids. I guess you didn't have to go through it with yours. It wasn't a huge thing at that point.
No, COVID kind of got in the way of prom.
COVID got in the way of prom. Yeah. So, but no, I mean, I guess I'll have to go through it at some point. You know, I'll start
coming up with ideas now. If anybody would like to come up with ideas, feel free. Call the show.
Yeah.
Give us some ideas. Email the show. Jason needs them for 10 years from now.
Yeah. I'll start keeping track of them. I will say, one, thank you for the tickets. My big guy, very much appreciated going to another game. I went to two games last week with my 7-year-old. The crowds are there. No matter the weather, no matter the day of the week, no matter the time of the day. I was there for a day game. I was there for a night game. I was there in a rain delay game. There are a lot of people going to this game, and they are having a lot of fun there, even if I object to them doing the wave.
Is this a baseball city again?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that ballpark is hot every night. It is a fun place to be. You look at Ashburn Alley, you just look at the upper decks when they pan out, and you can see just how many people are there. And it hasn't been, if you look to the start of the season, it hasn't been great weather. It's been rain and it's been cold, and the fans have still been there. Just wait till it's hitting season, like Charlie says, and it's hot in June and July, and the bats are actually supposed to be hot at that point.
Yeah, my only complaint about the stadium is that the Bulls changed their barbecue sauce.
Uh-oh. You got a complaint?
I think they're using bottled barbecue sauce instead of the one that they used to make themselves. But
that's disappointing.
Can't have everything, right?
They had Don Brown there last night. He was like at Bulls barbecue saying hi to people. And they're bringing back like all the past Phillies to throw out the first pitch. So I know you saw a lot of Don Brown.
So they decided to start with the disappointments?
He was actually very entertaining in the booth, talking about the 1 year that he had, that it was an all-star year. He was funny in the booth. They go out to Colorado this weekend, play the Rockies for a three-game series. Sanchez, Nola, and Suarez are the pitchers. You have your Coors Field.
Now, By the way, that was completely unplanned that I have a Coors Field hat on.
It just worked out okay?
Yeah, well done.
We talked briefly about just how bad some of the other teams are. The NL as a whole, only five of the 15 teams in the league are above 500 right now.
Let's talk about the Guppies, or as most people know them, the Marlins, for a minute here.
Oh, God.
Because you sent me something.
I was now wondering. You did not respond to me, which surprised me.
Because I get to do it on air.
Okay.
That's why it's fun.
Okay.
You desperately, as much as you have this little romance with JT Realmuto, that's only a one-way romance.
unrequited love.
It's unrequited love for you. You did not want that trade. You said that someday we were going to regret what was Sanchez was.
That's not true. I wanted Realmuto. I didn't want to give up Sanchez.
But you didn't want to give up Sanchez.
Yes, I wanted the trade. Yes. I didn't want to give up Sanchez.
Sanchez,
and I was wrong.
He's not only not a good pitcher. There, it seems like Sanchez multiplied, but all in his own body. Like, he's completely out of shape. He cannot pitch, and his manager
clearly has had enough of him.
Was
that appropriate to do that publicly, to call out a player like that? You're somebody who's, you know, obviously just coached younger kids, but mm-hmm. you've watched a lot of coaches and managers. We've talked to a lot of managers about sort of protecting your players in the media and handling those things in the clubhouse. We talked to Jim Curtin about that. We talked to Charlie Manuel about that, about not doing things in public and having those conversations. Was it right for the Marlins manager to literally go scorched earth on 6th?
I know that this is a Jason answer. I don't know.
Oh, because, well played.
But here's why it's, I don't know. You have no idea what they've done up until this point. I would have to imagine that the Marlins, over the course of the last few years, as he has been injured, as he has not pitched the way he has, as he has not kept his body in the kind of shape that it needs to be in order to be a major league pitcher, that they've had all these discussions with him and that this is the last straw.
Oh, I would think so.
If it's the last straw, then yes, you have to do it. If you've run out of options with a player who doesn't seem to be competitive enough to do the things that he needs to do to be successful when he has the gift that he had.
Are you surprised by that? You are somebody who watched Sixto Sanchez from his very, very early days in the mm-hmm. minors. Are you surprised that his career has turned out the way it has?
I'm never surprised with a pitcher who throws hard, especially a pitcher who, he wasn't that big. It wasn't like
he was always slight. He was the Pedro Martinez.
Not anymore, but he was supposed to be in the mold of Pedro Martinez, and that's not an easy thing to do, to throw with the kind of velocity he threw, when you're that small for a long period of time. He's done everything he can to make it worse, and that's what I don't understand. Like, it's not something that you expect out of a professional athlete. They take care of their bodies because that's their way of earning a living. He doesn't seem to be doing that. And who knows? Maybe there's a medical issue that I'm not aware of. But what you see out there is not, I mean, if somebody would put two pictures of them together, or if you and I had seen him the way we saw him in the minor leagues, did not see him till just now, you'd go, there's no way.
Unrecognizable.
That's not the same guy.
No, unrecognizable. And he doesn't pitch the same way. He just looks like a completely different person and player. And clearly, the Marlins have had enough. I mean, they seem to be over it all. Any final?
It's okay, though. I'm okay with the Marlins stinking.
Of course. Why not?
Yeah.
Any final baseball thoughts before we hit the break and then come back and talk more baseball with Dan Schlossberg and his new Hank Aaron book?
I just think that, you know, you get to Memorial Day and this is baseball season really starts. You're towards the end, and we can talk about it after the break and after the interview, but the other sports are winding down. They're exciting still, but they're winding down, and you sit there and the weather's getting warm and all you want to do is go outside, go to a ball game and just enjoy.
Let's hit the break. When we come back, we'll talk some Hank Aaron with Dan Schlossberg. Stick with us.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
Let's take a few minutes with Dan Schlossberg. He's a former AP newsman who's written over 20,000 articles, author of 40 baseball books, including his latest, Home Run King, The Remarkable Record of Hank Aaron. Dan, congratulations on the latest book. Thanks for giving us a few minutes to talk about it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Even though we're in Philly, we do talk to Braves fans. You've been a Braves fan since 1957, so this is a labor of love as much as it is a project that you're doing. This is your second Hank Aaron book, though. I was wondering if you could tell us where this one picks up. The first one was right before he hit the Home Run King. Can you talk about how the idea for the second one came about?
Well, a golden anniversary deserved some recognition, and so much happened to Hank Aaron since hitting that home run on April 8, 1974. It really needed to be told again and in a different way. This book is different than any other Hank Aaron biography because it's not done chronologically. It's done by topic rather than time. Each chapter was written like a separate magazine article. They were not written in sequence, and that makes this book different.
All right. Well, my first question before we get to the book is, why a Braves fan?
1957, Dodgers and Giants are leaving town. I live in northern New Jersey. Dodgers and Giants
as a Jersey City boy, that's why I'm asking the question.
Oh, there you go. Oh, Dodgers and Giants are leaving, even though the Dodgers played all those home games in Jersey City. And the Yankees, everybody rooted for the Yankees, and the Milwaukee Braves beat them, led by Hank Aaron. I watched the World Series at age 9 with my dad on the Zenith black and white TV. He turned down the sound, told me what was going on, and I fell in love with the Braves at age 9 and stuck with them ever since.
And so you follow Hank Aaron through his whole life in this book. This isn't just a baseball book. So I was wondering if we could kind of start in his younger days with sort of overcoming the segregation and the racism that he had to face and tackle. Can you talk about how, I couldn't believe it, he was assigned to an all-white team in an all-white league? That's how it started for him?
That's not how it started. Maybe professionally.
Or professionally in Jacksonville?
As a boy growing up in segregated Mobile, Alabama, he had to hide under the bed when the KKK was marching down the street in front of his house. So he watched his father give up a spot in line in a drugstore to a white man. Things like that really stuck in his craw. He didn't say anything. He didn't fight back. He was kind of a humble, introverted, retrospective or introspective guy. He was like Martin Luther King. He turned the other cheek. And Hank Aaron survived that way. And when he went down to that Sally League, every one of those cities was bad, he said. Everyone. There wasn't one city where he found any respite at all. He and Felix Mantilla and another black player integrated the entire league. It was tough for him. But when he got to the majors in 1954, he still had spring training segregation in Florida. Hotels in Cincinnati, St. Louis were still not integrated. So there was lots of trouble, you know, right through. Brown versus Board of Education, by the way, happened the same year Hank Aaron was a rookie. 1954.
You know, we all, obviously, anybody who knows baseball and the correct history of the United States knows about Jackie Robinson. But Hank went through a lot of the same things that he did. How was it that he was able to cope with it and still be the
the man that he turned out to be.
Hank got an early start with Jackie Robinson because the Brooklyn Dodgers came through Mobile on a barnstorming run. When Hank was a teenager, Hank played hooky from school to hear Jackie talk in the afternoon. And he was very impressed, and he made a point of meeting Jackie Robinson and befriending him. And pretty soon he befriended other early Black Dodgers like Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb. And Hank told me that those card games were like college classes to anybody else.
You know, you mentioned that Hank told you. As somebody, you told the history of how you became a Braves fan. What was it like for you to first meet Hank Aaron, talk to Hank Aaron, and then write about him the way that you've been able to do so?
Well, I started really early. I started in 1965 when I was a senior in high school and I wanted to do a column on sportsmanship. I sent a letter to Bobby Bregan, who was then the manager of the Braves, and I said, I'd like to come meet you at Shea Stadium, do an interview. And that was the day I met Hank Aaron, May 9th, 1965, and befriended him, stayed with him a long, long time, took a lot of pictures of me interviewing him and just of him alone. Some of those pictures, when I was a college senior at Syracuse and drove to Montreal, some of the pictures of me interviewing Hank Aaron at Jari Park in Montreal are in the book. So nobody can doubt that I've known Hank Aaron a long time. And Dusty Baker wrote the foreword. I befriended Dusty when he was a rookie in the early 70s with the Braves. He wrote a beautiful, personalized foreword, and it was just great. Everybody was so cooperative. And Billy Aaron, Hank's widow, gave me a wonderful interview, which turned into the epilogue of this book.
Can you talk about how 50 years later, many of his records still haven't come close to being touched, and it seems like his legacy is larger than ever?
Really true. First in total bases, first in extra base hits, first in runs batted in, first in what I call clean home runs, non-steroids home runs. He was consistent. He never hit more than 47 home runs in any single season, but he also averaged only 63 strikeouts a season. He was a rare slugger who made contact, and that's why Hank Aaron, it was sort of like the tortoise versus the hare if you're talking about some of the other sluggers who were around. People thought Eddie Matthews would break the record. They thought Mark McGwire might break it. Hank Aaron did it. Hank Aaron just hung in there, playing in small market cities in Milwaukee and Atlanta. Remember, Atlanta didn't become a big market city until Ted Turner and the Superstation in 1976. By then, Hank Aaron was retired as a player. So he overcame a lot, plus the segregation at the beginning of his career, and at the end of his career was the hate mail. He got 930,000 pieces of mail in 1973, more mail than any civilian who was not a politician. And the U.S. Postal Service even gave him a plaque. Dusty Baker said to me that Hank used to take all the hate mail he got and throw it on the floor so the other Black guys on the team could read it. And that's how they learned what was going on.
It wasn't... It wasn't just mail, though. It was threats. Before we get to the Bond stuff, which I know we'll get to on the clean, it wasn't just mail. It was threats. I saw he had two rooms reserved on the road, one for in his real name, one that he slept in because of the death threats against his family and him. There were FBI agents. He told teammates Dusty Baker and Ralph Garr not to sit next to him in the Braves dugout. Can you talk about just how much he went through in that chase in 1973 and 1974 to be a Black man taking the title from a white man at that time?
He went through a lot, and I'm glad you mentioned some of those things. On April 8th, 1974, when he finally did break the record, you see him hugging his mother and his father. You see him going over to hug his wife, Billy. You don't see any of his kids. The reason being, there were death threats against them, and they stayed with their biological mother in Jacksonville, Florida. They were not there at the game because of the death threats. And the reason he told Baker and Garr not to sit next to him was because he thought he might get shot during the game. There were all kinds of threats against him. In fact, the whole winter of 1973-74, when he was sitting on 713 home runs, one short of tying Babe Ruth, he didn't know if he would ever tie or break the record. He thought somebody might kill him during the offseason. And this is what Hank Aaron had to go through. What he accomplished is remarkable. If he had been white, who knows what he would have done.
What was the league doing? What was the team doing to make sure that he was safe and that he could be comfortable doing what he loved?
Well, the team helped him arrange his accommodations, his restaurants, things, especially on the road. Although even at home, sometimes he slept in the ballpark overnight. So the Braves did as much as they could to help him. But how much can you do? How much can you guard against somebody taking a shot at him anywhere? It happens to presidents even. So, you know, it was a very tough thing to do.
You know, he had to go through all of that and still broke the record, still was composed enough and still able to do his job and break the record. You talked about clean home run record. What was it like for a man that had to go through all of this unfairness to break a record, to sit there and watch somebody supposedly break his record, who we all knew was not doing it clean?
His relationship with Barry Bonds was icy at best. He did not go to San Francisco to congratulate him when the time came. He sent a videotape message, and people were surprised even to see that. But Hank was a graceful man, and that's why he sent that message. But he felt that his record had been usurped by somebody who did not deserve it. And if you look at Barry Bonds' record, the only time in his career that he hit more than 50 home runs in a season was 1973, when he hit, I'm sorry, was the year he had 73 home runs, which was 2001. That was the only time he hit 50 home runs in a season. That tells you right there that something wasn't right.
His career is one of experiencing disappointment, separate from the hate that he overcame, whether it was the team moving to the South, his failed attempts to be manager, general manager, commissioner of baseball. Can you talk about some of the setbacks that he encountered along the way, separate from the racism that he had to overcome in the process?
I'm glad you asked that, because I actually have a whole chapter called Awards That Weren't. Because in 23 years, he won only one MVP award and was not even runner-up in any other season. And talk about unfair, that's pretty unfair. And how about the Hall of Fame voting? Each Hall of Fame ballot has 10 spaces. Hank Aaron was left completely off the ballot by 9 voters. He should have been the first unanimous selection.
How much did that bother him, that he wasn't the first unanimous selection?
It bothered him a little. The point is, once you get in the Hall of Fame, you're in. Nobody asks you what your percentage was, or how, if you were unanimous or missed by one vote or a handful of votes. Nobody asked David Ortiz, how do you feel getting in with 77% of the vote? He's a Hall of Famer. But it hurt. It hurt Aaron. It was just another sort of almost like a nail in the coffin. But he knew he didn't get any respect. He was like the Rodney Dangerfield of baseball. He played in small market cities and was treated like a small market player, even though he was a big time player.
Well, not only was he a big time player, but even after his career was over as a baseball player, he continued to not only influence the game, but influence our society. You talk a little bit about him being a humanitarian, a civil rights leader. What made him, or what motivated him, to continue to be out there considering everything he had gone through?
He thought that a big name star should carry on Jackie Robinson's legacy after Jackie passed away. And it wasn't going to be Willie Mays, because Willie shied away from it. So Aaron decided he was going to do it. And being in Atlanta, he was right there with Martin Luther King Sr., Martin Luther King Jr., Ralph David Abernathy, Andrew Young, Jesse Jackson from Chicago, but he was often in Atlanta. So Aaron met personally and befriended these civil rights icons. In fact, Hank once said to Andrew Young, "What can I do to help the movement?" And Andrew Young said, "Just do what you're doing. Just play baseball and play it as well as you can." But after he retired, he really became a civil rights spokesman. He was terrific. And by the way, he's buried in the same cemetery, just about a row different from Martin Luther King Sr.
He was also a pretty political guy. There are 4 Democratic presidents that credited campaigning with him, with them winning the White House. Talk about his influence on the campaign trail.
Well, Hank never did figure out why Jackie Robinson was a Republican who supported Richard Nixon. That bothered him a lot, because he felt the Democrats were much better in advancing the civil rights movement and passing legislation that supported it. So right here, you see the picture behind me of Jimmy Carter with Hank Aaron. I was interviewing Aaron when Carter and the governor of Delaware, who's the man in the middle there, walked in. So Hank said, "Excuse me, do you mind if I talk to the governor of Georgia, Jimmy Carter?" The very next day, Jimmy Carter had announced, he was going to run for president. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution ran a headline that said, "Jimmy Carter is running for what?" But Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, and Bill Clinton all said they would not have won the White House without Hank campaigning for them.
So is that the big one that got away the day before your meeting with Jimmy Carter and you didn't get the scoop, huh?
No, I got it. That game was rained out, by the way. People don't remember there was a game rained out in September of 73 that couldn't be made up because of the way the schedule shaped up, and it was not important to the teams involved. So that game wasn't made up. Aaron might have tied or broken the record had that game been played.
You not only written so much about Hank Aaron, you clearly know a lot about Hank Aaron. Was it, as you wrote this book, was there anything that you were able to learn that you didn't know about Hank Aaron?
Quite a few things, actually. And they all wind up in the last chapter, which is called Aftermath. It was about what happened to Aaron after he left baseball. For example, Jimmy Carter right there. The Carters and Aarons became very friendly as families. They went on a ski vacation together to Europe. Unfortunately, even though Hank Aaron was a great athlete who played tennis and racquetball and was an avid fisherman and a great baseball player, played high school football, he couldn't ski at all. And he kept falling, and so did Jimmy Carter. And they kept laughing at each other. That I did not know. I did not know that Hank Aaron had any embarrassment as an athlete, but that was it.
Before we let you go, I have to ask, how did $50 prevent or change the course of Willie Mays and Hank Aaron from teammates to friendly rivals?
Great question. I'm glad you asked that question. The Boston Braves and New York Giants both wanted to sign Hank Aaron. He had been playing for the Indianapolis Clowns, a barnstorming team in the old Negro Leagues. And the Boston Braves offered $50 more than the Giants did. Now, to Hank Aaron, who left home with $2 in his pocket when he went to report to the Indianapolis Clowns, $50 was a lot of money. So he signed with the Boston Braves. That's what separated him from being Willie Mays' teammate. Can you imagine?
It's unbelievable. It just the book is packed with nuggets of information that just kind of jump off the page and really make you rethink how we got to where we did in terms of everybody's legacy. It's a fascinating read. The book, again, is Home Run King, The Remarkable Record of Hank Aaron. Dan, thanks again so much for the time. We hope people go out and get the book and enjoy it, too.
Thanks so much, Jason and Jeffrey. Really appreciate it.
You want to talk about somebody who had every right to look differently at society based on the way he was treated, yet chose not to and to be a leader. Hank Aaron is that guy.
It's impressive what he accomplished on a baseball field. More importantly, what he accomplished in life. I mean, we didn't even get to the point of his front office successes. I mean, he's just an impressive individual who went through things that are just unfairly had to go through.
Yeah.
We look at Jackie Robinson for all that he had to put up with in order to just be able to do what the rest of us got to do without all of this. And Hank Aaron seemed to have gone through pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. It seems like on a larger scale because of the changing media at the time, there was more attention and eyeballs when he was doing it than there was when Babe was doing it or when Jackie was doing it previous to that.
Does it not? I mean, to me, I get physically sick though when I sit there and see the death threats that he would get as he got closer to Babe Ruth's home run record. It's stunning.
Dan was nice. He did not mention it. He mentioned Cincinnati and St. Louis. Philadelphia was one of those cities that was not very friendly to players coming in when the color barrier was being broken. That was in the book.
We all know that. You can't hide from your history as much as some people want to do that in life. You can't hide from your history. And Philadelphia's history early on with baseball wasn't just Hank Aaron. I mean, if you ever saw the movie 42, the incidents with Jackie Robinson in Philadelphia you know, I remember taking my kid to that movie, and this is a kid who, you know, has grown up as a Phillies fanatic. I mean, he walked out of that movie as a child and said, "I'm embarrassed."
Yeah.
And it's something that we all have to deal with. And the question is whether you learn from history. And there are parts of this world that don't seem to have learned it, but people need to remember, they need to know these things so that we don't have these things happen again.
His legend definitely is larger 50 years later. I mean, they just unveiled another statue for him last night at the stadium where they're playing.
It's the third one, right?
The fourth one, I think.
Fourth one. Okay.
So, I mean, he continues to get the recognition, frankly, that he didn't get when he was a player at times. Yeah. That's the irony, is that when he was earning it as a player on the field, it was passed and looked over. Now, afterwards, as his legacy builds, he gets more attention and recognition for it. So,
and you know what? We touched on it a little bit. When you have to do everything you have to do to break, I guess I would say, the most hallowed record in all of sports, the home run record. I can't imagine any that's more revered. And to do it under the circumstances where he was afraid that he wasn't going to be able to get the record, not because of he wasn't going to be able to hit a home run, but because he was afraid somebody was going to assassinate him.
Could you imagine telling me not to sit next to you because you were worried that somebody was going to shoot you?
Well, I might do that, but it's not because...
No, you wouldn't tell me not to sit next to you.
I just make up the excuse, right?
Yeah. You'd say, can you hold my seat?
Yeah, can you please sit in front of me?
Yeah. I mean, we make light of it, of a very serious thing. But like that is just unbelievable.
Right, but keep in mind, he had to go through all that to get the record. And people who think that somehow that would mean that he's bitter because, or it's petty because Barry Bonds broke the record, supposedly, and I'm using air quotes. He did it clean. He did it the right way. And he had to do it under circumstances nobody should ever have to deal with. And then Barry Bonds comes in and just does it his way. If you know that history, isn't it even easier to understand why Hank Aaron would feel the way he did?
Without a doubt. I'm really glad we got to talk about that book. Mm-hmm. We got about 10 minutes left. I do want to get to your NIL article that was published this week. Let's do a quick hit on some playoff hockey and playoff basketball. You could have gone to bed early watching the playoff basketball game last evening. Mm-hmm. You would have stayed up very late to watch the hockey game end with Connor McDavid ending it in double overtime. Your thoughts on what we're seeing in the playoffs right now?
It's playoff hockey. Like, is there anything better than playoff hockey?
Only if it's your team playing playoff hockey. That's sure. The only thing better than what we're seeing right now. Although I'd feel much more anxious watching it. But I mean, the emotion in that arena last night, and then just the stunned silence when McDavid ends it in the second overtime. It's just like unbelievable.
There is nothing better in sports than playoff hockey.
And the viewers are agreeing. The first two rounds of the 2024 playoffs are the most watched in NHL history, averaging 1.16 million viewers across all of their platforms. So look, TNT is going to need it because they're losing the NBA next year. So, well, they'll have it next year. They'll lose it the year after. You going to miss Inside the NBA?
Yes, I will. Yeah. But look, the NBA playoff, the NBA is a great product. The playoffs so far to me have not been a great product, but even my bigger problem is, and I have complained to you off the air about this a lot over the last week, is the rehabilitation of Kyrie Irving without any evidence as to why it is we're rehabilitating him other than he's in a conference final.
He's a new man, Jeff. Just accept it.
But it's based on nothing that we've seen. I don't, just because he hasn't said stupid things publicly or hasn't said ignorant things publicly does not mean that we need, just because somebody does well in a sporting event does not mean that we need to rehabilitate.
It's based on the same recency bias that spurs these best ever debates when somebody hits one good shot. It's let's rewrite history based on how it feels today. And so Kyrie said good things at a press conference last night. Good for him. That doesn't change the things he said in the past. And people who want to tell the story without including that, they're doing a disservice by only telling part of the story.
Okay.
Does that bother you? That
immensely. If you can, you obviously can see my face, and
I can.
It bothers me immensely.
Unfortunately, I can, yeah. But no, I mean,
but history, let's talk about history that is changing.
Yeah.
Where some people think it's for the better. Some people think it's for the worst. And most of us have no freaking idea where it's going.
Well, you have more idea than me because you're writing about it in law articles and stuff. First, talk about how you gave the history of this week in a law.com piece, tracing how we got to this point with NIL. And then we'll talk about some of the news this week too.
I mean, it started so long ago, and that's the thing that I didn't really follow until I did this article is that this all started decades ago, and we got here because, as we've talked about on the air, the NCAA and governing bodies didn't deal with it. They just kept thinking that they could continue to control the narrative and control the money flow, and what ended up happening is, because they didn't get ahead of it, the courts did it. So everybody knows about the O'Bannon case, O'Bannon who played at UCLA. Everybody knows about how there was a video game and the players' likenesses were evident, even though they didn't have their names necessarily on the back of the jerseys on the avatars. They had their height, their weight. They had their skin color. They had their hair color. They had their jersey numbers, and they had their school. And I don't know how stupid they thought we all were that we didn't know, because every time you played that game, you were that guy. That's who you were. You said every kid who played that game said, "I'm this person." And based on the fact that the avatar was very much like them. And because of that, they ended up winning. And that led to what we call NIL, or name, image, and likeness, and them being able to earn a living off of their names, their images, and their likenesses, instead of the schools getting all of the money. And the NCAA, as we talked about before these rulings came down, the NCAA did not get ahead of this. They arrogantly just kept fighting and fighting and fighting. And now we have it completely out of control, to the point that there's no way to stop. This freight train is completely out of control, to the point that Tennessee, we now had players being able to get this money. But now it's become a recruiting tool, to the point that last week there was a lawsuit filed by one player. So you now have Tennessee and Virginia going to court and saying, "Hey, by the way, you can't stop us, NCAA, from using this as a recruiting tool." And a court said, "Okay, NCAA, you can't do it. Right now there's an injunction. You can't do it." And now you have player, at least one player, and I'm sure there will be many others, saying, "I got recruited to a certain school, and they promised me that I was going to get certain NIL money, and they didn't follow through. So I left that school, and now I'm filing a breach of contract lawsuit."
And not for like $20, like
millions.
Yeah.
And you asked me the question of, okay, well, does this mean that players can sue the schools or just the coaches? And my point is, while it's unfair necessarily to automatically assume that the school is liable, somebody's got to maintain some sort of control over this.
Well, and I ask that because in the Florida suit, the one that's being discussed, the Florida football coach, the university booster, and an NIL staffer are being sued. But it doesn't look like the school is being sued. And that was, I wasn't sure what the liability was of the entity that hired the coach, if the coach is being considered liable.
If they get one whiff that the school knew about this, or that the university was involved in this, there'll be a motion to amend and the school will be at it. Right now, they're going after coaches. The problem is the coaches don't have the money. If you sue and win a $10 million lawsuit, how many coaches are going to be able to afford this? The schools are going to have to pay it, I would assume. I don't know what the coach's contract says, but there might be what's called an indemnity clause in it. And if there's an indemnity clause in it, the university might be responsible for it at the end of the day anyway.
And look, I mean, the next step in this all, we've seen all five power conferences agree this week to allow schools to directly pay players for the first time in the 100-plus year history. We've seen each conference vote to authorize settlement of this House versus NCAA lawsuit that argues players from the pre-name, image, and likeness deserve back pay, and that the definition of NIL should expand to include broadcast revenue, So now you've got the NCAA.
Well,
the-
so which now makes it more of a revenue sharing issue. So NIL is companies, private companies, offering money to athletes, essentially for endorsement type things. What this will do is it'll now open the door to revenue sharing, where universities are sharing the revenue they get as opposed to advertising dollars that are paid separately. That money will now go to athletes that will share in it with the universities they play for.
Does all of this end up keeping kids in school longer if they're getting paid and getting NIL money? Those guys who will go into the draft, but they'll be kind of on the end of the bench or the end of the roster.
It does. But here's the question that I have that I've been thinking about lately. Does this mean the end of scholarships? So the universities have always argued that players are being compensated through scholarships. You know, for those of us who don't have kids that were athletes in college, we pay $250,000 plus for our kids' education. That they're getting their education opportunities for free. The universities could decide, you know what? There's no point in this anymore. Education isn't the issue anymore. Let's just set up a separate part of the university that is just a private athletic competition. And that's it. And let's not pretend to send them to school, which would be a shame because most athletes don't end up in professional sports and do get an education and then have a career outside of sports.
It seems like we are not at the beginning of the road, but we're also not anywhere near the end of the road when it comes to this. Would that be a fair way to say it?
I think that there's a lot to come. And one of the other things is what happens to all the sports that can't share in revenue.
I think that's something that's definitely going to be talked about. Got about 15 seconds. Any final thoughts? Say something profound, Jeff.
It is Memorial Day weekend. Go enjoy a baseball game, drive safely, and have a good time. And I got nothing else.
That was profound. Thank you to everybody who served. Make sure to join us next. Thanks for joining us this week, as I don't even know how to say goodbye anymore. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.